Thank you for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. And if you're just learning about this show, please know this show is on the air for you. And we do it by bringing on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain. Our goal for each show is to bring answers and options to making your lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And remember, if you can't listen live, go to our website at answers.network and browse through a variety of heartfelt and enlightening topics. I am confident that there is something you will find to bring greater joy to your life or someone you know. Now, I have a favor to ask. Please forward at least one of our shows to your social media groups or to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is just one powerful way that we can make a positive influence in the world together. Now, over the past year, we have gotten questions from parents and teachers asking for help in dealing with a variety of issues they are seeing in their children since the lockdowns that started in the spring of 2020. And we've had even more questions lately. So it is apparent that as the day-to-day effects of the pandemic ease, our children have been left with having to play catch-up, learning the social tools and skills that parents of young children have taken for granted for the last 3 years or so. Now, to help them, many parents need a new toolbox to foster their child's emotional intelligence, an essential character trait for children to succeed in our fast-paced social society. Now, our guests today are child development experts and authors of The Emotionally Intelligent Child, Effective Strategies for Parenting Self-Aware, Cooperative, and Well-Balanced Kids. Rachel Katz, who holds a Master's of Science degree in education, teaches social and emotional learning skills to parents and children. With more than 25 years teaching experience, she is the former head of the Discovery School at the Bay Area Discovery Museum and head of social and emotionally learning for early years at Dulwich College in Beijing, China. Helen Hadani has a PhD and is currently a fellow at the Brookings Institution, where she conducts policy-focused research on the benefits of playful learning in both formal and informal contexts. She is also the former director of research at the Bay Area Discovery Museum. Rachel, Helen, welcome to Answers Network.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, I am so pleased that you could be with us, and I think the timing is just right. But one of my thoughts is that when did you start writing this book? In other words, was it before or during the pandemic?
So I'll start and tell a little bit of the story, and then Rachel can definitely fill in. But we did start writing the book like right at the beginning of the pandemic, although we had the idea for the book before COVID. So even before COVID, you know, sort of changed our world as we know it, especially for parents and families and children. We worked together at the Bay Area Discovery Museum, looking at how, you know, evidence-based and research-based practices could help inform, you know, writing curriculum and building out activities and workshops for parents and children. And what Rachel and I found is that some of this, you know, bringing research into the classroom in different forms was really extremely helpful in terms of educating parents and how to support their child, develop social and emotional skills, and helping children themselves understand sort of their social and emotional development and helping them through this journey. And so that was sort of the start of writing the book. And then, yes, just as it happened, we started the actual process of writing during COVID.
Well, as you were putting this together, and first of all, I am a firm believer, and anybody that's listened to this show knows that I think that we're going to make our best moves forward as a society by starting with parenting and starting with younger children. So I think it was great that you guys were doing that. But as you were putting your approach together, How did it change, you know, when the lockdown started? Because if you're trying to put this book together and then all of a sudden you go, wait a minute, this changes a lot of things. What are some of those things that you saw right away?
I can take that if you'd like. My name is Rachel. So when we were in the classroom and we were working with the students, you know, to back up and to support what Helen said, we had this idea of, wouldn't it be interesting if children could understand and we could explain to children developmentally how their mind develops and what thoughts are. And this idea that thoughts then will inform your beliefs and your actions and your behavior, and then that will somehow have a result. So sort of the cause and effect. When the lockdown happened, we had to, you know, I was still working with children and everything went online. And so I very quickly had to shift and sort of think, how can I use Zoom to teach about social and emotional intelligence? And how can we, you know, how can we continue to develop the framework that we're writing and that we're working on for the book in, you know, not being in person? And what was really interesting was I discovered that children were absolutely as eager to talk about their social and emotional worlds on a camera and in Zoom. And in some ways, they felt very safe to share what was happening with them, because for a child, the context, you know, they weren't all sitting, they couldn't sort of reflect on the fact that, oh, I'm not in this, you know, space in school with my friends. They could just see their friends on the screens and felt very connected in some ways and were very open to share what they were feeling. And I thought it was really surprising. I actually used, because I have a background also in writing and developing children's television and directing it, I could use the frame of the picture in a way, you know, the frame for entertainment. So in our, Helen and I, in our programs, we use a lot of puppets with young children to get them to talk about social emotional intelligence. So I would just use my puppets in the Zoom screen. And it was like, oh my gosh, it was like entertainment and social emotional learning. And so it was just, it was a very interesting shift. And we continued to talk with kids all, you know, the entire lockdown.
Now, is there any statistics or anything that we can compare? Because it seems to me that what you were doing was so helpful to be able to keep these young people, these young children, moving forward in their growth. And yet we're hearing a lot of feedback from kids who didn't get what you're talking about, of having really sort of stagnated in their emotional growth. Are there any statistics yet, or is this still too new?
I don't know of any specific, you know, statistics that we can quote. I think it's still, you know, we're still sort of learning the impact and the effects of the pandemic on children's, both their academic learning, which might be a little bit easier to measure in terms of, you know, as many people say, sort of falling behind and children need to catch up in certain skills. But I think in the social emotional realm, it's a lot harder to measure, I think, because there are so many individual differences and just those types of skills are in general, you know, hard to measure, in especially in very young children. So I don't know if Rachel has anything to add on that front in terms of having sort of hard data and what we know about children. All we know is that they did have, you know, several years where they were not able to interact with their peers, with other important adults. You know, the upside to that is they spent a lot of time, most children spend a lot of time with their family, which has many, many advantages in terms of their development and healthy development and growth. But we do know that that time that they were not able to be in person with peers in a classroom setting or even outside a classroom setting had a significant impact on many children and developing these sort of social emotional skills that they need to interact successfully with other people.
Now, has there been any discussion about bringing what it is that you're doing into the public schools? I mean, this, it seems like, with or without a pandemic, this seems like something that could be so incredibly beneficial across the board.
I think in many schools, they are starting to have more and more social and emotional learning programs where they're mm-hmm. really helping, and also mindfulness programs, really, where they're helping children to look at impulse control and to become more aware of their thinking and how their thinking affects their behavior. And if your school doesn't have a program like that and you're interested in having a program like that, it's certainly worth it to go to your school board or to maybe even the PTA and talk about that and ask if there's a program that they would start, or and a parent can certainly look for a program too.
Okay. So have you had a chance to really sit down and talk with some of the parents to see the benefits that they're seeing, you know, the feedback that they're getting about how much better they feel that their children are responding to them at home based on getting this type of feedback when they're working with you and going through some of your programs?
Well, so we wrote the book, The Emotionally Intelligent Child, Effective Strategies for Parenting Self-Aware, Cooperative and Well-Balanced Kids. We wrote this book so that if there was not a program, or if a parent was working on their own, or even, you know, you have a child who's not even yet in school, we wrote the book so that the book is actually also a program. So the first mm-hmm. part of the book explains the development of emotional intelligence, where we look at the development of theory of mind, the development of language, the development of executive function, and how your family and your cultural will impact this development. And then the second part of the book is a framework for parents on how to approach emotional intelligence with your child. And we give suggestions, we have a framework, we have lots of tools that you can use, and we mention, and we make them all very user-friendly and very developmentally appropriate.
Now, are some of these broken down more for different age groups? Because I know that we will get questions that will be sent to us, and, you know, there'll be a question, you know, especially during the pandemic, you know, I'm being driven crazy, you know, my 6-year-old, and then they'll go on and talk about whatever it is that is not working for them. And yet then we'll get something else from a parent that will talk about the teenage years and asking for help in that area. So is the book broken down in such a way that a parent with children of almost any age can go right to the area that they're looking for?
Well, the book, we do focus on different ages in the book, and there are strategies and tips for different ages. I will say that most of the research and evidence we talk about in the book is really focused on the earlier years. So we would say birth up through early grade school. But mm-hmm. we do talk about, for example, Rachel mentioned this area of research called theory of mind. This is around really understanding our own sort of what we call mental states, our beliefs, our intentions, our feelings, and those of other people, and how those interact and how we can use those to shape our interactions, you know, hopefully successful interactions with other people. And so for an area like theory of mind, there's so much development that is happening in the early years, toddlers, preschoolers, early grade school. But we also talk about, you know, sort of further developments later on. So for older children. So I will say that, yes, we do break down a lot of the tips and advice we give parents. And also for the research, we talk about how different, you know, how it applies to different ages. I wouldn't say we talk too much about, you know, sort of the teenage years in the book, but I think a lot of the strategies can be used with older children and even adults.
Okay. And when you were just speaking in regards to that particular theory, what are some examples? So for the parents that are out there, they're either sitting with their child or their child is out at school right now. What are some examples that a parent might, upon hearing that, go, you know what, I think that really is what we're going through, or a great tool that will help them in their particular situation?
So I can start with this and talk a little bit about the research perspective, and then I'll hand it over to Rachel to talk more about sort of like in practice, what it might look like to support some of this development and these skills. And so again, going back to this area of theory of mind, it really is about, you know, understanding how our sort of inner world impacts how we connect with and interact with other people. So for children, for example, an area of theory in the theory of mind, we talk about toddlers, you know, really young children. And actually they come to understand some pretty neat things about people's desires and what they want and how that drives their actions. And even something simplistic that we think of, that something that we like, for example, animal crackers or vanilla ice cream, somebody else might like something different. And that's actually a pretty big revelation for a really young child and can help them sort of understand that maybe their friend sitting next to them wants something different. So they should think about that when they're, you know, when they're in a play date situation or classroom situation. And then when we move up to the preschool years, that's when children come to understand something really interesting about our beliefs and our beliefs about what's true in the world. And again, how that drives our actions. So if we think that the ball that we're looking for is in the garage, we're going to go look in the garage, even if in reality, it's somewhere else. Right. So for children to make that connection, again, is really sort of helping them make their social interactions more sophisticated and being able to interact with other people sort of on a different level. And then just to give one last example, for older children, we talk about sort of school age children, we talk about this concept of stream of consciousness, right? That even when if you look at somebody and they might not be, you know, looking like there any thoughts are going through their head or there's any thinking going on there, we sort of know that there's always sort of thoughts and ideas going through our heads. Oh, and we have this sort of constant stream of consciousness, even though sometimes we may not want that. And so that's, again, something that children come to understand, that our mind is always at work. So that's just a few examples of, you know, sort of from a developmental perspective, what researchers look at in this area called theory of mind.
And Rachel, what are some of the examples you would think of?
Well, I loved Helen's examples. So she sort of explained the science of it, but I want to explain what that might look like with your child. Yes. So if you sort of say, okay, my school age child understands that people can hide their feelings. You know, prior to this, your school, you know, your toddler didn't understand that they can feel sad on the inside, but on the outside, show a really happy face. And so that's a really powerful thing. The idea of, oh my gosh, you know, I can go to this birthday party and just, you know, I don't want any of the other people at the birthday party to know that I don't like chocolate cake, but they've served me chocolate cake, so I'm gonna eat it with a big smile, right? So, I mean, these are huge developmental things. And then the stream of consciousness, if you think about it, it's not until school age that a child realizes, oh my goodness, my mom actually is thinking all the time. And I have no idea what's going on in her head unless she tells me, or from her facial expression and her body language. And I know that she can hide her feelings. So these are really complex things. I mean, if you think we're just layering and layering and layering the understanding of mental states as we develop this understanding. And one of the things that Helen and I try to do is make young children understand and their development, make it really explicit and really cool so that we can say, hey, I know you're thinking. This whole mental world, the whole emotional world, mostly happens on the inside, but our actions and our facial expressions can show what's going on. And again, we can fool it. So it's this whole invisible world. And it's really important when we say to our children, isn't it so cool we have this invisible world? This invisible world, let's get some language to be able to talk about this invisible world. Like, let's really think of all the different words that can explain anger, so that when you go to tell someone what you're really feeling and thinking, you have the right word. So again, I mean, that's just one example of how to make this incredible inner world explicit, understandable for a child. Even the fact that you, with the stream of conscious thinking, you might start to tell yourself you're not so good at things. You know, mm-hmm. that happens to children developmentally at a certain age. And then that goes along with that school age where you start to hide your feelings. You know, if it appears as if your friend is much better at something than you are, but you don't want your friend to know that, you start to hide that. But then your inner tape recorder is going, you're not so good. You're really bad. Mm-hmm. And this could be the first time a child actually can hear those inner words and like, oh my gosh, you know, like, and then they can start to believe that. And when we make mm-hmm. it really explicit to a child and say, actually, you can back up, you can hear your beliefs, you can hear your thoughts, you can change them, you can work with them. How cool is this? They love that. The ball drops for them, like, I'm in control.
And yet it sounds a little bit like it's the good news and the bad news in regards to how they start to learn in regards to their feelings and the possibility of hiding them. So I want to take a quick little break. But for everybody out there, if you know somebody, especially somebody that it's with young children, contact them real quickly and have them log on. And you can also log on as well in another open up another box on your computer. We're talking about the emotionally intelligent child, effective strategies for parenting self-aware, cooperative, and well-balanced kids. And who doesn't want that? So we're speaking with Rachel Katz and Helen Hadani. We will be right back. Stay with us.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. We are talking about the emotionally intelligent child, and with us are child development experts and authors of said book. Now, what I'd like to do is jump to, we have some listener questions, and I know that we're on a little less time, so I want to make sure that we get to these. This one reads, just before COVID hit, my husband was transferred, and we now reside in a new state. Our 11-year-old daughter is doing very well academically, but she refuses to try to make friends or do anything socially. I could really use some advice on how to pull her out of this cave she has crawled into. She uses her fear of catching some illness as an excuse sometimes. I did buy your book, but would like your thoughts on what we can do. And this is from Kathy in New York.
I can take that. Kathy.
Okay.
Thank you. Is that okay, Alan? Yeah.
Oh, please. No. Kathy. I'm saying, I'm not sure between the two of you who wants to, so that's up to you guys.
Okay. I mean, I can start. Kathy, thank you so much for your question, and we appreciate that you bought the book. So your daughter is 11. Again, remember, Helen and I are experts with the early childhood development, but we are also parents ourselves. I would certainly, you know, absolutely create opportunities to ask your daughter what's going on, and to, let me think about this. Maybe I would certainly suggest maybe having conversations with her about friendship, not necessarily encouraging her to look and make friends, but just begin the conversation of what friendship means to her, what she's looking for in a friend, how she might know she's found a friend. So first, you know, there's that part of our book where we talk about inquiry, where we really have to ask our children questions about what's, you know, how they're feeling at the moment and listen very carefully. And our questions being more specific than very, very open-ended, you know, or sort of switching back from big open-ended questions to specific questions. So just beginning a dialogue about who, you know, who were people that really held that place of special friendship, so she can talk about, reminisce about her friendships and start to think about what she's looking for in a friend, might be a nice way to begin. And then from there, just keep checking in with her to see if, you know, now that she knows what she's looking for in a friend and has defined that, how is that going for her? Has she found anyone at school? Has she found anyone in any extracurricular programs that might help her or that might become a new friend? Helen, do you have anything you'd want to share?
I mean, no, I agree with, you know, sort of everything Rachel said in terms of really thinking about questions and how to make these new connections and really, you know, emphasizing that making new friends in a new place is a really hard thing. And so it's something that definitely takes time and that there are different, you know, we often may focus on sort of school and an academic setting in terms of making new connections and new friends, but to remember that there's lots of different sort of opportunities and social circles for kids to be connecting. And maybe, you know, there could be something even in with the neighborhood or community activities that would be a good outlet for meeting some new people. But really, yeah, I love Rachel's words of wisdom in terms of thinking about what is it that she's looking for in a friend and how, and then trying to help her sort of make those connections in different settings.
Okay. Now we've got another question that I think goes along this, and it's for a little bit younger, but this one reads, we've been homeschooling our children since they were 4 and 6 years old. They are now 7 and 10 years old, and we have been told by both family and friends that we should worry about their social growth. We don't find ourselves worrying about that because the group that we are doing the homeschooling with seems to cover those bases. Are we being delusional, or you know, or do you believe that, you know, that the homeschooling of today can also provide proper social growth? Your thoughts?
I really would you like me to start, and then I can, and then Helen, you can add in.
Please.
I really, yeah. I mean, thank you so much for that question. I really appreciate it. I think first and foremost is, again, this idea of turning the lens to your child and looking at your child. And if they seem to be okay in social settings, if they seem to be able to communicate their needs and are thoughtful and kind, and you as parents feel okay with their social, you know, and emotional growth, and the groups that you're working with in the homeschool settings are going well, then I think you're sort of off to the races. Everyone will share an opinion. I mean, that's sort of what happens when we're parenting, you know?
Exactly.
And that's really part of the mind framework that we set up. It's also that non-judgment, you know, we talk about this N of non-judgment and this D for decide in our mind framework, which is mindfulness, inquiry, non-judgment, and deciding. And so you can really get to that non-judgment place of saying, do I want to judge myself? Like, how do I want to see myself for having made this decision of homeschooling, you know, and being kind and compassionate to yourself for having made that decision and noticing how your children are developing, and then deciding that big D of just, well, I absolutely appreciate and respect the people that I love are concerned about my choices.
Mm-hmm.
I feel good about them. I've made them, and my kids are doing well. And I think as a parent, we know when the kids aren't doing well, and then you get to decide, okay, I need to make some changes. But if you feel good and everything, you know, seems to be on track, then it's, again, thank you so much for your care and your concern. We're doing great.
I love that answer, by the way. Helen, would you like to share?
I think it's a great question. And I think it really highlights that learning, whether it's academic learning or social emotional learning, can happen in so many different contexts. And so, like Rachel said, like if your children are, you see them thriving, you know, socially and emotionally, and they're making connections, maybe they don't have some of the same, you know, social situations or challenges that you would find in a, you know, in a more traditional classroom setting. But there are other ones that they're going to face in terms of, you know, being homeschooled. So I think that, you know, if we see children that are, you know, growing socially and emotionally, and they are not having issues connecting with others, then I think there's many different settings that this development can happen in. And it doesn't have to be a more traditional classroom setting. And especially in the social and emotional world, children are making connections, you know, through different ways. Now, even through, you know, they're very skilled at making these connections online, even, and there's nothing wrong with that. So just seeing that there is, you know, constant development and healthy growth, I think is the, you know, number one thing. And to remember that learning in any context can happen in many different settings and environments.
And again, I thank you for that. And I really thank this listener for the question. And I want to add something to it as well. You know, I recognize that when I went to school and my parents looked at the possibility of homeschooling, it wasn't even an option, really. And then as a parent, when I looked at that option, I was concerned that they wouldn't get the social interaction that they would need. And I saw the difference of them going to a very, very small school, private school, and going to a very, very large school. So that I think there's benefits to both. Now at being more like a grandparent age, I have seen some really incredible groups within your city or your community that have set up some incredible homeschooling communities. So I think for anybody that's thinking about it, don't let somebody, because of either antiquated thinking or biased thinking or whatever, tell you what's best for your child. So that's why I love both of your answers, because I feel like I've seen this on a lot of different levels. I also, at one time, sat on the board of a magnet school. And what I found was the public school seemed a bit jealous and actually did some things to kind of keep funding away and really was more focused on making sure that they got their funding than making sure that other kids that were choosing to go to different schools or different types of learning got everything that they need. So I think that, again, just as both of you have said, you know, for these parents, you know, find something that works for you and go with your gut and do what's best for your kids. And doesn't mean you have to listen to everybody else. And I loved the part about, thank you so much for taking this interest, but I'm going to do it this way, you know, and I know you said it much more eloquently, but I think that's a great answer. I'm checking our time. Okay, I've got time for one more. And again, this one came in that says, I'm looking forward to listening to this interview and sharing information about your book with other parents from our church. We have started a parents' night just for the purpose of discussing the social and emotional problems our kids are experiencing. We feel it's important to up our efforts and build strategies to improve our communications. I'm hoping your book will be a good resource for us. Are you aware of any book groups that are currently using your book? And if so, what has the feedback been? And this is from Vicki in Minnesota.
Oh, Vicki, thank you so much. I love that. I love that you're even thinking about this. gosh, you know, I've often run parenting groups, but not used the book to run the parenting groups because we were, you know, this framework we've used for a long time, and then we've put it into book form. So if you use the book and start a book group, reach out to me or Helen through LinkedIn, yes, and let us know how it goes. And, you know, I can speak for myself. I don't want to speak for Helen, but I would be absolutely happy to come and speak one night at your book group. So, yeah, I mean, best of luck with all of this. You know,
I'm just going to say I love that. And I really wish we had more time to go into that. But what is the best way for them to get a hold of both of you to be able to do just that?
Well, I think like Rachel said, we're both on LinkedIn, so you can reach out to us through that. And then I don't know if there's a way to follow up with any listeners. We're happy to share our emails if that's how people want to reach out to us.
If you're comfortable with it, we can give them now, or we can put them on the site so that they can find them, you know, on our site as well. Whatever you're more comfortable with. And in regards to the book, can the book be gotten wherever, you know, is it at Amazon, Barnes and Noble?
Target, yes, all the popular places to buy books, it's available. So thank you in advance to your listeners who are going to buy the book. But yes, we would love to connect with people that are running book groups and people that are interested in learning more about it.
All right. And again, for everybody out there, the book is called The Emotionally Intelligent Child: Effective Strategies for Parenting Self-Aware, Cooperative, and Well-Balanced Kids. Again, that's going to be the biggest benefit to our next generation, is to do just that. And if you have your favorite local bookstore, I'm confident if you go in and you tell them, if they don't already have it, they can certainly order it so that you can also continue to promote local business as well. So anyway, thank you so much for both of you. I don't think there's a better way that we can make a positive difference in the world than to do exactly what you're doing. So thank you so much. I honor and respect both of you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank
you. You're very welcome. All right. For everybody out there, be with us next week when we're going to be joined by author Stephen G. Post. And our interview will share details of his new book, Dignity for Deeply Forgetful People. This is the way of respect for those with dementia and Alzheimer's. And unfortunately, we're at a time in which most everybody now knows somebody who has dealt with that. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answers.network, or you can subscribe to the show through Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, YouTube, and so many others. For everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.